Welcome, one and all, to the podcast dedicated to exploring the vast media landscape in search of its finest creatives. I'm Darren, your host. Welcome to Heroes of the Mediascape. My featured guest today is author, photographer, and filmmaker, Liam Quain. How's it going, man?
It's going great. Thank you for having me, as the standard response is. But genuinely, it's been a long time coming, but I'm really happy to be here on your new show.
Hey, I'm happy to have you here. So, win-win. Well, let me start you off with a cold opener here. Quick question for you. I was scrolling through your Vero page earlier. What was it like meeting Hayden Christensen?
That was chaos. That was one of those. Have you seen, do you know the Comic Con type things? Mm-hmm. Where you know they have the guest stars and they appear and they take photos and do autographs. If anyone doesn't know what they are, they're like big event exhibitions in like plane hangars at arenas, and they just certain celebrities come, whoever they can book, and they do personal meet and greets. And on the day I was there, there was just Hayden Christensen and Rosario Dawson were doing appearances. So I ended up just getting, I wasn't actually going to meet them. I was going to meet some other people. And it was one of those things where the arena was so big and so chaotic and everything was laid out as well as it could be. But it is just this like hive of, you know, just like activity, and you're bumping into everybody, and there's just like everywhere you turn, there's just you've gone down a hallway to a place you've never seen before. Even if you go back on your own steps, it's a different place. It's like the house from The Shining. So I ended up accidentally joining the line to meet Hayden Christensen, and I ended up doing two loops of that line. Because it was too early the first time, so I just lined up for something like an hour waiting, and then they said, okay, the line starts now. So then it turns out when I got to the front of the first go, I was at the back again. So I ended up waiting another hour, and by the time I'd done that, I'm not an idiot. Well, I am a bit, but like it was just one of those things where it was kind of like overwhelming, and times were different. Times weren't as they said they were going to be, that type of thing. It was all like, it was just a strange experience. So by the time I'd lined up the second time, I only had enough opportunity to meet one person. And it turns out it was the biggest person who was attending at the moment. Well, not the biggest, but like kind of the biggest flavor of the month at the time. Cause, it was, about, I'd say, half a year after they did the TV show, Ahsoka. So it was still like kind of riding high on the return and the nostalgia thing. So he was there. And when I got into the third and final line, that was when like this military rule keeping came about. From like, the staff were great, but I just got the photograph. I didn't get the autograph, but I just had to say I was there for Jumper. The movie Jumper, because I love that movie so much, and I kind of just wanted to be different, so I didn't want to mention Star Wars, because I think I love Star Wars. I love specifically the prequels. I really do like them, but Jumper's kind of like, in terms of like movies, it was the one that got away, where they didn't make a sequel really, and that I watched it when I was younger, and it's like been burned into my soul. I need a sequel. So I've got the books. I haven't read them yet, but that was the one I was going to have to present as the movie that I see him being, you know, famous for. And it was one of those. You got the high five, handshake, and the thank yous and the thing. But then I think the meeting was genuinely like 5 seconds, and then out you go. It's like immediately like shoved out the door. So that was it was like each guest was a beach ball, and they were just getting passed over by the staff. It was just like, you just seeing people flying as they were getting kicked out the doors. Other than that, it was one of those with the photograph, kind of had to smuggle it out, because it was when you get it, I didn't have a bag, so I was just like, I don't know what to do with this. I went into panic mode and just was trying to smuggle it out like it was something stolen. and I was just cut my whole trip short just to keep it safe, which makes me sound like a giant dork, but oh well, it's like, it's what you're there for.
Absolutely. No, that's so cool, you know, and obviously I'm a huge fan of Jumper as well. I've given multiple shout outs to that show on my other podcast, Round Two, the film sequel. And speaking of, we're on that podcast as well. We did a couple different podcasts. And just before we jump into that part of it here, I just noticed, I think you're wearing the same shirt now that you did in that photograph with Hayden Christensen. Am I right?
Yeah, that is embarrassing. Yep. That's actually from another part. Yeah, this shirt's from another podcast as well. Well, I know it shouldn't be embarrassing because it's like the meet and greet like was like what like half a year ago, so it's not that embarrassing. But it's like I only own one shirt. I don't. It's just a coincidence.
That's funny.
I could get a coat. No, it's do you know when you kind of have a shirt, it's just like one of your favorites, so you continuously go with it because it's from a podcast itself. It's a podcast called it's a Right Hive, and it's like an event itself in a similar way, except it's all digital, and it's an author conference, and this year, funnily enough, was the 1 year I couldn't do it, but they give like a t-shirt to the guests every year, and I've got like two so far, and they're really good. They are just like really well made, so I just keep them close all the time. You don't give out t-shirts, do you? You should start giving out t-shirts. I want a t-shirt. I want a t-shirt with your head on.
But I don't know if people want to really look at me that much, but cool idea. Yeah. For the listeners of the show who aren't watching the video version, what does it say on your shirt?
Oh, it says, I can't read. It's backwards to me.
Just for clarification for the listeners, it says, "I am sorry for what I did to your favorite character."
It does. That's what it says.
It's kind of poetic and kind of resonates in a way with the Hayden Christensen story as well, if you really think about it.
Yeah, that's true. I am with the Star Wars prequels, I have kind of a reading into that movie that I've never said before. Can I do that? Can I just say, like, give an interpretation of what I think the third movie is actually about?
Cause, floor is yours.
Thank you. I've been trying to get like just the Star Wars thing going, just so I can tell the story. But there's like a novelization coming out very soon, and I'm kind of got it in the back of my mind that maybe it's in there, and then that'll be in the news. So I was like, no, I want to tell it. I want to actually say what I think the ending is, because it's very specifically, I think it's something that a lot of people miss, and I'm not saying it's a fact, but it's kind of from the filmmaker in me, the interpretation I think might resonate a tiny bit more closer to being what was intended, because from a point of view of a film editor, which is how George Lucas liked to direct, he hated on-set direction. He liked to direct in the editing booth. And something stood out about the ending of the Revenge of the Sith that I genuinely think a lot of people haven't clicked onto. It's, in my opinion, anyway. As spoiler alert for Revenge of the Sith, Hayden Christensen's character becomes Darth Vader, becomes the big villain, and he does this to save the life of the woman he loves, Padme Amidala, who was a senator and original queen of Naboo. And in the script, and specifically in the movie, she dies. It's one of those like Greek tragedy style stories where the hero turns into a monster trying to save his love of his life, and then she passes away, and then he gives in fully and just is consumed by the monster itself. So he becomes Darth Vader, the robot machine, alien, scary man with a red sword.
But sword?
On his laser sword, lightsaber. My apologies. On his way to becoming Darth Vader, the way it's written and the way it's actually delivered in the thing is his wife, Padme, she gets choked by Hayden Christensen's character, Anakin. Why am I describing this like people don't know what Star Wars is? That's so stupid. So yeah, he does a force choke. And she collapses, and then that gets her out of the scene. And then the next, she's pregnant with twins at the time. And the next time we see her, she is in a hospital bed delivering the babies, and Darth Vader is in a post-lava battle meltdown hospital bed, being brought, turned into a robot, to in order to, help him survive his battle wounds from that he got fighting Obi-Wan Kenobi earlier, and their journeys towards life and death are shown simultaneously with the cross-cutting effect, which is just going back and forth, and to each one of them. So she's giving birth while he's being born again as Darth Vader, the iconic character we all know. However, in the cross-cutting, it's not the actual first time that it happens in the movie, and there's something that stood out to me when I last watched it, specifically halfway, when Anakin is, Hayden Christensen's character, is trying to figure out what he's going to do and give in to the temptations of the dark side to save his wife. There is a very specific scene where each of the characters, Padme and Anakin, are looking out of windows in their represented directions, as if they are connected. There's she gets like overwhelmed with bad news, and then it cuts to him crying. Like they have, I genuinely believe the characters have a force connection. And at the end, it says, while Padme is in the hospital bed delivering the twins, her vitals start to drop, and the nurse says, she has lost the will to live, and people interpret this as she's dying of a broken heart. And I do, this is a very popular interpretation. There was a poll on that social media network called Reddit. Everyone knows Reddit. There was a poll on that, and it was like 86% or something of people believe that it was she died of a broken heart or something like that, and they thought it was stupid writing. I don't believe she died of a broken heart. I think Anakin was sucking the life out of her to come back, not on purpose, because that same cross cut happens again, it with the delivery and the rebirth. And as Darth Vader is coming to life, he's thinking about Padme, and she starts to lose her life as he is coming back. And I think he accidentally sucks the life out of her life force, and uses it to stay alive as Darth Vader. And I think that's why afterwards the Emperor Palpatine says, "You killed her," to Hayden Christensen's character. So I don't think it's a she dies of a broken heart. I think he sucks the life out of her and accidentally kills her in order to stay, cling to life himself. So that's my theory.
Okay. Yeah, it's like the birth of Darth Vader happened at the same time as the death of Padme. Yeah. It's I'll say this. I really like that interpretation. I wish it was a little bit easier to tell, and if that was the intent of George Lucas, I think it was too subtle to the point where it just obviously went over most people's heads, since most people seem to buy into the theory of her dying of a broken heart, which is also an interesting concept. But I think, in a way, I think it probably could have been executed a little bit better. But it's one of my favorite Star Wars movies, so I mean, it's nitpicking, I think, at that point. But
I understand. Like, it does outright tell you about the broken heart thing, and it is inspired by the Greek tragedies, where, like, and the old Shakespeare tragedies, where characters just like got bad news and then just collapsed. And it says, "What happened?" And it's, "Oh, she died." Like, that was how they used to do it.
Romeo and Juliet.
There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, that's the theory that I've been holding on to, like, for like months, just like desperate to just to say it on a microphone, because I was gonna, put it into writing and stuff like that. But I went, I can't. I need to talk. I need to say it, because it's hard to word. Because it's very dry and boring and long-winded, when you're just talking about cross-cutting in an article form. So thank you for letting me tell that. That's a big weight off my shoulders. That means probably nothing to nobody but me.
I'm
But
always down to talk Star Wars, so I always love to hear different interpretations, different viewpoints, perspectives. That's part of why I enjoy podcasting as a whole. And, you know, I really do like that theory. It makes a lot of sense. To me, I think it makes it better and more impactful. So I'm totally
with
you.
That'd be great. Thank you. I was going to actually ask Hayden Christensen personally, but then they started like pushing people out. So I genuinely didn't get a chance. But that was the main reason why I stayed in the lines as long as it did, because it went, well, at least I get, this is like drawing me to do that. So at least I can get that off my chest. But it didn't pan out. If anybody's watching who knows him, just ask him personally. Or don't say I sent you. Just ask him like a normal person. Don't bring up internet strangers. He won't care.
Yeah, don't be weird. Well, yeah, and it's funny because that movie, Revenge of the Sith, that was the last episode that I have done as of this moment, published, I should say, anyway, for round two of the Film Sequel Podcast. I'm looking to do more. Hang tight. Promise. It's coming back. And speaking of that show, I've had you on there a couple different times, and it's been a lot of fun. We've talked, the first one we did, I believe, was My Hero Academia, the sequel, Heroes Rising. And that was a pretty fun episode. Get to talk anime, you know, something that's maybe not as mainstream, maybe to me anyway, I guess. I don't know. But I feel like it's cool to explore something like anime, because at least on my podcast, I don't think I'd really done that much up to that point. It was also just live action stuff. So it was really cool, a fun episode. Are you excited for the final season of the show?
Behind, so I'm not going to get it at the start. I'm so excited. It was one of those things where I was going, I'm not going to bring it up. It's one of those where I'm so happy it's over, because TV shows used to be these experiences where you wanted to, every week you wanted to like just watch the same story being told over and over again in the procedural sense, and you didn't want it to end. But with animes and all those things, because they're like published and they're really well crafted, stretching things out can ruin some things. A lot, if you ask any anime fan, they'll bring up any sequel series that they now despise, which from ones that they love, like the Naruto series got extended into one called Boruto, and everybody, well, a lot of people in America and England despise Boruto because it kind of gives new meaning to the original series and changes a lot of things. But I was a bit worried that I like Boruto, but I think My Hero Academia is so very political.
How does color lend itself to viewing a film or a television series through a political lens?
Okay, so it all comes down to political parties, specifically in America. A lot of the political parties, obviously the most popular colors are red and blue for the two main parties that are chosen by the country as to be the two opposing parties, and it's red and blue. And I believe a lot of people have caught onto this color scheme, and they are trying to tell stories in order to kind of maybe affect politics in a way. I think they hope to affect politics in a way with the storytelling. So those two colors are used predominantly now with heroes and villains, depending on who the person supports. And I think the first thing to start this off was going back to Star Wars, with the red lightsaber and blue lightsaber, and the heroes are blue and the villains are red. That when George Lucas was asked about why, he said because they are. That was the reason given. But if you want a possible concrete reason as to why he does not support the red party, he supported the blue party. So the villains were red, the heroes were blue. And ever since the 2016 election, I do believe a lot of people have gotten this blue and red storytelling device. I do believe they've hooked onto this as a primary tool in order to tell the story that they hope will affect an election. So a very recent example of this, actually, it's becoming so unsubtle that people are actually catching on, and I've seen a number of tweets and, you know, Reddit posts and Blue Sky posts with people doing this as interpreting the red and blue as a joke, but I don't think it's a joke. I think it's on purpose. The TV show Peacemaker has characters, and one of them's in red armor and one of them's in blue armor. I seen that and went, okay, we know who the heroes and villains are. And the heroes and villains, it was supposed to be a twist that the blue one was not evil and the red one was not good. But again, going with the color scheme, it was inevitable that the red one was going to be villainous because the person who makes it supports the blue party. So that's how the story was told. And yeah, inevitably it came to pass. And the two characters specifically, one of them's I think he's like kind of a right wing, he's kind of like a bruiser. And the other guy is this old man character. He was villainous, but he kind of isn't anymore. The post I seen was Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And that was a joke. It's supposed to be a meme. But I do believe that was the point. That is what they're trying to do. And I think that's why it was written that way. And I think it was written that way on purpose in order to kind of explain electoral outcomes. Because, spoiler, do you mind a spoiler for the show? Because that technically isn't a spoiler.
Go ahead.
But this one will be a spoiler. The both characters die, and the deaths of both of them is, it brings a lot of trauma to the main character because he loves both of them. So that in itself is trying to educate the audience, in my opinion, that this is what happens in electoral battles when you a team, as they call it, team. It's not a team sport, but they'll call it a team, loses. It hurts people. Like, so you can celebrate if your party wins, but remember, there's people on the other side who are struggling, are scared, and they'll suffer when the other ones win. It's just like, it's a story that's been going on for so long now, and I do think it was hyped up by the 2016 election. A good example, actually, is another DC show, which is The Flash, where they took away the main character's costume for the last, like, three seasons because it was red. And the only way that makes any sense is they wanted to tell the show more with less effects, but they didn't. They had a lot of effects. They just kept the main character out of costume. So looking at it through a political lens, why would they do that? Oh, because it's red, and the people who make it support blue. So they're uncomfortable having red as a hero on screen. So that explains the change. Doesn't mean it's true, but it explains it if you're looking at it through a political point of view.
Interesting. I have a few different questions that come to my mind hearing you describe some of that. I believe in The Flash, granted, I haven't seen the whole series. I kind of stopped watching once season four started. I couldn't do it anymore. But I believe it was a season three. They had, was it Savitar?
Yes.
No, spoiler alert, as the main antagonist. He is blue, right?
Yes.
And he's portrayed as a villain.
Yes, and that's where the dynamic gets shaky, but it is kind of explainable when you think of that version as the objective version. So instead of that one being the enforcement of storytelling with a hero and a villain thing, somebody might look at it more objectively and go, well, that's who are fighting, the blue and the red. So if you have red, then they have to be fighting blue. Doesn't matter if it's the allegiance of the character, those colors still have to appear. You know what I mean? So it's just showing again that the clash being the red versus blue, because spoiler alert, with Savitar, he is the main character.
Yeah.
He's Barry Allen. So like, he is the hero, but he's just not. He's a darker version of the hero. So that can be, if you look at it through the political lens, you could say maybe they're saying the blue party's gone too far in some areas, or they're a darker shadow of the former self, that type of thing. Maybe they are criticizing that the party they support. Maybe they don't support it at all. But it's like, there's still a lot to work with, you know what I mean? And I think that's why a lot of people... Yeah. Come to, and I know the primary colors, I know they're reflective of each other, I know they're kind of, they have the dynamic of verses where it's red and blue, the contrast, but this is again a lens, so it's like it's not just a visual thing for contrast, it's like it's only when you're looking at it through the politics part, through the viewfinder,
right? Yeah,
There's a lot more we could go into. There's so much more.
I know what you mean. I just find it interesting because, for people who aren't familiar, maybe I should have brought it up earlier. You don't hail from the U.S.
No,
you are from the U.K.
Yes. Yeah.
How did you come to having this fascination with this topic and exploring it in the way that you have? Being that you're not from the U.S., but that seems to be the main point of emphasis for your argument.
Yes, it is, and it's a good question. I am under the belief that I can crack where my own politics is going in my country by watching yours, because we copy. So a lot of the stuff that goes on, like, you know, any certain political events happen in yours, it follows, and we eventually get our own little version of it. So it's the way I picture it is we're kind of the father and old, like, old father of America, and we're trying to copy the son to remain young, or the daughter, whatever America is. Probably a son, because I know Lady Liberty's a daughter, but, you know, she's also French. I do see it as, like, copying. So we've now got our own sect of political commentators who are using the phrase "Make Britain Great Again," which was the original phrase that Alan Moore coined in V for Vendetta. "Make Britain Great Again." It was a pun, and his fascist character has it as they have it as their party slogan. "Make Britain Great Again," because it's Great Britain. So, like, it was a pun. It was like a well-written pun. And then America, you know, the "Make America Great Again" thing come out, and now it's been Americanized to the point where there's people in my country so desperate to be American that they are just blatantly trying to, like, interfere with politics, but also, like, kind of asking for help overseas. So I do think, like, monitoring pop culture is a good way of kind of not predicting the future in a way, because that sounds pretentious and stupid and weird, but it's a good way of kind of getting a handle on, like, your expectations. For example, there is, like, when 9/11 happened, we had our own bombings a couple of years later, and we don't specifically, like, have a holiday around that or a day of remembrance, but that significant event is kind of crystallized on, you know, our news broadcast on the day. There is an anniversary. It's just not. It wasn't as the tragedy wasn't as large a scale in terms of, as in the tragedy was there, but it wasn't as a large scale attack. So I'm surprised we didn't give it a name. It was the bombings. It was a certain train got bombed, and it wasn't big enough for a day to be carved out like 9/11 was, but we still had the same broadcast theme style of imagery, the same, like, you know, write-ups, the same articles, the same pundits going off the back of it and, like, trying to use it as a political tool. And at the moment, I'd say if you don't mind me going on this tangent really quickly, at the moment, the face of British politics is now heavily focused on defence spending, which is a stereotype of American politics. And we're doing that, so our country is now, politicians in our country are now siphoning as much from the public purse as possible to put it into defence initiatives and to buy American-made weapons like Lockheed Martin jets that famously don't work and are a joke in the aeronautics community, but we'll buy them because we are the son, we are the Dovran old father, and we will do what our cool son tells us to. So watching, plus the country loves America. We do, like, America is seen as, like, the destination for the rich and famous. So it's like the second stage of success, really. If you make it big in London, you could make it big in Los Angeles. Like, that's the atmosphere of our celebrity culture. So I do think pop culture is a really interesting tool and a useful tool to use in order to get a grasp on the way your countries work, because you get to see kind of how the other side live. And also your politics is kind of a bit more interesting. You have more colourful characters. But at the moment I'm looking elsewhere. I've been going, like, you know, with, as you were saying, like, talking about anime and stuff like that, I've been looking into anime more because it's more surprising. Now stories of anime are more surprising compared to, I know I've just said, like, earlier that one of them I knew the ending of, but that was a specific case. If I watch a TV show or a film now and it's American, I follow the colours and I can guess where it's going to go. And a lot of the time I'll be right, not because I'm clever, but because this numbering system has been made worse by, you know, a corporate ruling regarding, like, you know, like algorithms and how, you know, paint by the numbers stories that audiences want, test screenings. This all, like, is a perfect environment to allow these rules to thrive. So a lot of movies go with the color system, and a lot of them American movies. So I've been looking at, like, you know, Chinese cinema and Japanese cinema now because I'm not as familiar with their politics, and and their colors have different meanings. They've already always had, like, different meanings with, like, in Japan, purple seems to be the color that's evil. So they still use the color system, but they have, like, different meanings ascribed to their colors already. So they like have a color system of their own that they have, like, symbolism for. So it's not primarily rooted in politics. So it's easier not to be able to look through that political lens with them. So I kind of been looking at other cultures and other markets, if that answered the question at all.
Absolutely, yes. That was a really good answer. I really liked it. Yeah. So if you want to hear more about that topic, you could definitely check out our episode we did on Godzilla, King of the Monsters, for round two of the Film Sequel podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one's fun. Like that's the like concentrated orange juice version. That's really strong. Like that, the other one.
Right.
Like, it's,
yeah. And as for the movie itself, I feel like it's pretty evident that I think you were a little bit bigger a fan of it than me.
Yeah.
But I think that's cool. I like that, you know, there can be differing opinions and, you know, maybe it just goes to show that some people like some stuff, some people like other stuff. And even if I didn't love the movie, there's still enjoyable aspects of it that make it worth watching.
Yeah, it's visually, like, it's visually stunning. It's, they tried things, they swung big with certain characters. Like, I did like in the King of the Monsters, I like the mom character specifically, the mom of the Millie Bobby Brown's mother, Vera Farmiga. I can't remember her character's name, but she was really well tailored character to me, just because she did do what I thought she was going to do, but which was the redemption story. Spoilers: redemption. She did have a redemption arc, but it wasn't salvaged. She wasn't alive. She couldn't live as a character, which is very unique. Usually, they kind of don't go far enough to, like, have a character be redeemed, but have them die in modern blockbusters. Which I know they did do that in Star Wars, which, again, we're going back to Star Wars, but I do think it's had such an influence that's now the blueprint for redemption arcs is Star Wars one. So, but as I said, a lot of people don't usually follow it to the death of the original villain character. So that was interesting to see in the monster movie, because a lot of the time, if I'm correct, the MonsterVerse seems to have characters survive ultimately, like Bryan Cranston. I think the survive lock was, there was backlash to Bryan Cranston's death in the first Godzilla of the MonsterVerse. So I think, like, they keep characters alive for a lot longer now because of that backlash. But so it was just refreshing. It was just refreshing and interesting. But I remember you. One of the things I remember you pointing out was the character standing there while the monster was there and just, like, roaring back at it, which was ridiculous. Do you remember when Yeah, just he's just standing there, and is it what is it? The is it Red? Is it Fenway Park? The baseball field. Was it? It's in Boston. Is it? What's the one in Boston?
Yep, Fenway Park, yep.
Yeah, so she's in the middle of Fenway Park, and the big giant gold dragon just like settles over, and she just goes rawr, and it's just like, yeah, you are a Katy Perry song, who you really are. So yeah, that was really funny at the time. Because that's the thing that stands out a lot is characters just don't seem to run when they need to.
Right. Yeah. And since we're on the topic, I did want to ask you really quickly, what are your thoughts on Godzilla Minus One?
Minus One, that is, it's Minus One is my favorite Godzilla movie of all time. But again, for a slightly different interpretation. That was when I watched Minus One. It was one of those screenings that was just perfect. And then someone got the phone out in front of me and made a TikTok, and I just like told you know when you kind of like crash out a little bit and just tell people to shut the fuck up, sit the fuck down, turn the fuck around, stop being a fucking pain in the ass. It was one of the so it just ended like that. So it was I had to go and see it again. Just to have like a like just some screening harmony. It's just like a normal screen, and please, like everyone, please stop acting like you're in your living rooms when you're outside now. You're not. I know COVID was a long time, but you're not in your houses when you're watching movies. Please put your phones away. It's very annoying. It's starting to become a bigger problem, I've noticed as well. People like recording movies. It's very annoying. Anyway, Minus One. I love that film so much just because it kind of it was doing that thing again where it was kind of like telling me like politically things are going to be okay, that type of thing. Because just in case spoilers for Minus One, just in case I get into them, but I really did think the franchise needed a Japanese reboot. I think it was more valuable to the genre than like a Western reboot, because as we were talking about before, paint by numbers has to follow a certain thing, has to follow a certain pattern, whereas Japanese storytelling doesn't. It has to follow that specific pattern, so it was more interesting, and it was nice to see the original design kind of updated and the story shrunk down to making Godzilla a villain again, because that was the thing that people have fond memories of, the Toho Godzilla superhero era, and because we were in a superhero cinema era that become popular in the West, and even in the East, Godzilla was kind of like heroic in his other films like Godzilla Final Wars and stuff like that. But then they announced Godzilla was going to be a god and a malevolent one, and if you did not specifically worship to a point of being awe-inspired and fearful of him, he will kill you, or it will kill you. And that was the thing that's been missing for so many years with the Godzilla character, because Shin Godzilla did do that itself, but there's also hints that Shin Godzilla might have been human in that storyline, and it was also cut off before it got a sequel, which would have had this like insane Evangelion like cocoon scene where Godzilla hatches into this like feminine white angel character with huge spreading wings and humanoid features. It would have been really cool to see, because it would have like completely spun the Godzilla franchise on its head, but that was stopped. So with Minus One, we got to actually address bigger things like conflict, war, the guilt, and imperialism as a whole. So I really thought it was very valuable as a film, and it was just great. And now that they're making a sequel, I'm not that pleased, because they are making a direct sequel, aren't they? Godzilla. It's probably going to be called Godzilla Zero. I don't think they're going to call it minus two or plus one, because Godzilla plus one sounds like a wedding invite,
Right, yeah. I
which would
mean, if it
be
was minus
hilarious.
two is like a sequel.
That's true.
You
That's
could
true. It might do that.
marketing reasons could be interesting, but I don't know.
Yeah, because it's a direct sequel, it's another one of those where I just want it to end. So now that they're doing a direct sequel, it's like, no, you might ruin the original by doing something weird and unnecessary and maybe even like politically dangerous in this current climate. Nice new prime minister, by the way. She's not a monster at all. She is a monster. Obviously it's not my place to comment on their politics, but obviously anti-immigration sentiment is rising, so I'm not really looking forward to watching a film that caters for that audience with Godzilla being fighting off and some sort of invader as a metaphor for stop the immigrants or the country will die. So I'm expecting that to be the case. Godzilla's going to be fighting an invader. And he's going to be a hero again. And as I said before, that's been done. So I don't want him to be a hero either. But I do think he's going to be heroic. What did you think of Minus One?
I think it's a really good movie. I think it's really cool that they're able to make it on a smaller budget like that, but make it look like a large scale budget. I think that's probably the most impressive aspect of it.
Really cool. Really cool. The visuals, the blue, like just the spines when he was doing the beam, and it just like the spines just jut out, and then like the nuclear bomb mushroom cloud. It was just the visuals were amazing.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, isn't there a black and white version?
There is. I've got that. I haven't watched it. I've got the movie on 4K, and I've not watched the black and white version, but there is. I'm gonna give it some space because I think I've watched it like 7 times since it was out. So I
Oh,
like,
wow.
yeah. So I've watched it a lot. I've mainly to show other people because I really, really liked it so much that it was one of those like you will sit down, you will watch the thing I like, and you will enjoy it. So I've been doing that a lot. Oh yeah, actually, there's one more thing as well. Have you ever seen the movie Your Name? This goes back to the anime.
Your name?
Yes,
No, I have not.
it's called Your Name. It's me my favorite movie alongside the My Hero Academia movie.
I think I've
It's
heard of it.
yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like it's an awful like masterpiece movie that's just. It was, I call them life-changing movies. Do you know where you just watch something and it's just like, oh, everything's different now. Like, my world has completely changed. It was one of those movies for me, and I kept thinking of it when I was watching Minus One. For some reason, it kept cropping up in me mind's eye. That movie just kept on hovering over it. I wasn't sure why. And it turns out that the main character from Godzilla Minus One is the main character of Your Name. But because he's a voice actor, I was hearing the voice. It was like a subconscious reading of it. I did not know it was him. It was only on the second watch that I realized it was him. But there's also a character who's got the same name as the main character from Your Name. His name's Taki Tachibana. And there's a character in it called Tachibana who shouts at someone and calls them Taki. So I think that is a cameo, a specific cameo to link with the voice actor. But it was the fact that I didn't know it was him. I didn't even recognize his voice, even though he's the voice actor in my favorite movie, because I'm one of those visual learners. So I was just like hooked on the imagery. I just didn't put it together. But it was only after the second watch that I realized that's why I kept thinking of that movie all the time. His voice was in my ear. It was strange. Fun though. Fun though. Just
Yeah,
little
absolutely.
things. Yeah, I like little things like that. I just like that's like kind of like how I like working with movies. It's just like I like to extrapolate what I can from them and just engage with them in a different way than good or bad, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I like it. Very cool.
You do that
I do
too as
want
well.
to, I do. I can't help it. I can't help it, you know.
Fun.
Yeah. I want to ask you about a review you wrote for The World's Divide. And I want to pull this up here because I was reading this recently and there was a part that I just thought it was just so amazingly written. Like you got to read this whole article if you haven't, because for listeners, because it's just, I thought I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. It's so good. So
Thank you.
I want to just read this quick excerpt. Okay, fine. You dragged it out of me. I burst into tears 20 minutes in. But they were manly tears distilled from draught beer and Dorito dust. Although the world and characters and lo-fi fantasy world are somewhat visually reminiscent of those from Nadia, I hope I'm saying that right, The Secret of Blue Water, and the well-worn Last Airbender series, thankfully that would only be a surface-level assessment. I think I heard the artistic chimes of Akira and Watchmen echoing from within, stories that are close to my heart and that have inspired work of my own. And like those stories, this one carried with it an important political message that is worth paying attention to. A big theme of political resistance, and the narrative examines the many different forms such an act can take. What begins as a simple science fantasy story, a hero whisked away from one world to another.
Thank you.
That
I repeat
is an epic
myself a lot.
Paragraph.
Thank you. I repeat myself a lot. I'm talking about politics again. That movie was, I give the movie credit for that, because if it is good at all, like, that is what inspired it. I glazed that movie so much. It was just so good. It was one of those things that was really easy to write about, just because I enjoyed I didn't kind of hold back with it. I was kind of lucky enough to get like a screener, press screener type thing for it. And with that, that was kind of that's just a nice thing to be able to have, just like access to something, just to do work around it. It was just a nice thing. So I watched the movie expecting just, you know, a valiant effort, because it's the selling point of the movie is it's an animated adventure movie, set, you know, in a political world, like overtaken by, like, you know, fascism and military rule, and it's like the characters hop to another world and it's all green and lush and like a Studio Ghibli painting. So I thought it was just going to be like Avatar and stuff. But the selling point of the movie is the filmmaker specifically is one person who made the movie. His name's Denver Jackson. And The World's Divide is a product of his. I don't know how many years he's worked on it. Something like 4 years. And it was like 18-hour days or something. Or like 15 to 18-hour days of constant work with the software program Blender, which is the free, it's really good that it's free, because Blender's like the VLC media player of like visual effects, 3D modeling software. It's like beloved because it's generous and it just believes in the art form itself, so they don't aggressively monetize anything in a certain way that is off-putting or like gatekeeping. It's just a nice program made by nice people. So this movie was handcrafted by one guy. It was produced by some of the... I think it was produced by their partner, filmmaking partner. And it had a Kickstarter, but the Kickstarter was only for... it was only specifically for the post-audio effects. So like the voice acting, the... sound effects, the music, that was where it come in, but all the visuals were handmade by this one person. And I have seen worse animes made by full studios, like it's 3D, but I've seen worse animated projects made by like studios of hundreds. The sheer like level of complexity and just like fidelity that is, you know, the effort that has gone into it is just gargantuan. I genuinely believe everyone, if you can watch it, because it deserves the support. And it's like one of those, it's an independent project that's just it's just well made across the board. And I say in the review, I've forgotten that it was made by a single individual that way, because it was so well put together. I just got lost in the story. The writing was incredible. The character work was just absorbing. So it, professionalism was there. So it did feel like a full studio. It felt like something like Blue Eyed Samurai or a Netflix animation, where Netflix does this like 3D low frame rate animation style, Spider-Verse style. Like that's how Netflix kind of a lot of the time does things. It reminded me of Spider-Verse a little bit as well, with the way it was moving and the attitude of it. It turns out there's a lot of the sound effects, the music sound effects and all the audio, a lot of them were done by people who worked on the Spider-Verse movies. So that was kind of a nice connection there. So yeah, it's just an extraordinary movie, The World's Divide. And thank you for the compliments on the writing, but as I said, it was just easy just to write in any way, just because of how good the movie was. It's in my top three of the year. At the moment, I'm not sure the order, but the movie called Nizar 2 or Nerjur 2, the Chinese animated epic, that one is number one at the moment. But it could change. And Fantastic Four is number three. The new Fantastic Four, I really enjoyed that movie. And which is says a lot considering I was saying like I'm bored of a lot of Western movies. Fantastic Four kind of came through as just a nice movie that I really enjoyed. It was I did think it was going to go off in different areas and it didn't, so it was very surprisingly faithful adaptation of the original comics with Galactus and all that. So yeah, that's been like my main takeaway from the movies. I've not been doing much in terms of movie watching this year, which is a shame, but I've been doing more writing, way more writing, like a big project on the horizon. So I'm trying to concentrate on getting that done, and that means like money has to be allocated for that.
Yeah, you know, speaking of your writing, let's get into it, you know. You are an author. You wrote this novel called Road to Juno. Would you like to describe to viewers maybe who aren't familiar with it, what is the main topic? What is the main storyline? What is Road to Juno about?
Thank you. I will. Road to Juno is a post-apocalyptic. It's a post-apocalyptic novel. It's set after World War III, and it follows a super-powered family who go to war with a cosmic god to stop World War III from happening for a second time. It's one of those. It's kind of pulpy in a way where it follows a family of three. Well, it's not really a family of. It's a family of two, but the apparition of another family member's felt across the novel. And I don't want to do one of those pretentious things where it's like the city itself is a character. Like I don't like that type of description. So like I'm not gonna really say it's a full character, but I just needed to write a novel about superpowered people punching each other through buildings. I had to do that, but I also had to like pile everything into it I could, so it's got all the bells and whistles of sci-fi and fantasy. So it covers time travel, it covers science discovery, adventure, pulp combat, politics, but it's also got a lot of theory behind it. It's got a lot of like predictions for what the future could look like. It's got a lot of what I think are answers for problems people might have now in their own lives regarding like their agency and journeys to like what goals of what they want to do. It's like it's very in some ways it's very uplifting, and it's like kind of an anti-nihilist text where it specifically dices up the concept that nothing matters, because I've seen that too much. But that was my first novel I wrote, and it took me 9 months, and now my second book is coming out 4 years later, and so that says everything about that one. It's tricky, but one of my inspirations for it, which you didn't ask about, but it gives me a chance to
Not
talk
yet.
about it.
Not yet.
Yeah, it gives me a
Yeah.
chance to talk about it. I really like the Man of Steel movie. I like the Superman movie. I like the Snyder movie. Like I like them movies.
What's that?
Like.
I haven't heard of those ones. What's that?
Well, I think that's how we met as well, because we met on Vero, didn't we? So it's a nice like unifier. I kind of wanted, as I said, I wanted to make one of the things I said initially with when I was constructing the book itself was language. I want to make a Man of Steel no one can fuck with, because I needed like a story what showed powerful beings being powerful and a world reacting to it, and I needed it to not be attached to an adaptation, and I needed to like get rid of that anchor off its foot. So the best way of doing that was to kind of invent my own kind of mythos to tell that story in a in an inspired way, but like in a in its own unique way. Because yeah, there's superpower people punch each other through buildings, and that specifically is the imagery I pictured was like Man of Steel and that type of thing. But not it's not really that similar in any other way. It turns out I took a lot of inspiration from Akira, and that's what I liked about Man of Steel, because it turns out that took a lot of inspiration from Akira too. So I think that's the glue that held us together as connected pieces, like franchise pieces. It was like the the scene with the satellite in space, when that's in Akira, that kind of broke the mold for power storytelling, like power fantasy storytelling. Because have you seen Akira?
Yes, a while ago, but yes.
Yes, well, you will remember there's a big space laser that's used in it, and in order to combat the space laser, the superpowered villain slowly rises and just exits the atmosphere of Earth and takes the satellite down physically with his bare hands. And that was kind of a mind-blowing image for me as a film watcher, because it did this thing that live action doesn't do. It never explores people using power in a way that isn't kind of visually magical. It wasn't visually magical. It was just a person hovering, finding something, and then doing it. And it was only with Man of Steel that I kind of got that feeling again. So I wanted to explore that type of power fantasy storytelling, where it was people who were flying, but they didn't have costumes. They would just fly through space. They can breathe in space. That's all explained. And the characters themselves are kind of, because they're like kind of two or three of a kind, or four of a kind, if you want to get spoilery. We follow their journey to understand themselves. So they weren't born with like a textbook on understanding where your powers come from or how to use them. So it's characters who have this basic form of wish fulfillment fantasy power, where if you see a car in your way as you're trying to cross the road, you can put your hand out, it will stop, and then you can lift it with your mind and it will move. That's what they happen to be able to do. But the thing that makes it interesting is the characters don't know how they can do it, and their imagination is a surprisingly good weakness, because they can make things happen physically in the physical world, but they don't know how far they can go. And also, it's up to them to come up with ways out of problems. So, and that is kind of how I wanted to make the like kind of biggest power fantasy I could, where these characters can physically change the world of the story around them. They can like these characters, like the characters in like the DC and Marvel universe, like if they were put together, not in a rivalry sense, they could like strip them down to the atoms if with a thought. They could want to do that, but they have to know they want to do that. They have to understand that they have the ability, and that's where the drama comes into it, because it's following this family going to war with this cosmic being, and it seems to know more than they do about the shared power connection and how to like navigate its problems more. So it's like this faceless chrome creature who dominates the place everywhere it goes. It can invade your dreams. It can physically reshape cities. It can change the course of politics on its own, but it doesn't have a face or a voice. So it was kind of this like specter that haunts the book, and that's the villain. But with that comes like, it's like the lingering question of what are you, what can you do, and just how much does humanity benefit from your presence? Because if you have wish fulfillment powers, it's going to be really hard to keep human relationships. So it's like if you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a partner, and you happen to have these powers, how unfair is that to the relationship? Like that, they're the type of things it covers, where it's almost like their very existence in this world is so out of place that it itself is kind of this aberrant. It's like a, it's not an aberration. It's kind of just this, it's a problem that I believe reflects a lot of, things in our own world, where people kind of don't understand how much power they have, how much influence they have, how much of an impression they can make on people. And it's basically a book telling yourself to have some introspection, watch yourself, be nice to people, don't be nice to people aggressively, don't be aggressive at all, just think ahead before you do things, and just understand that you just share a planet. And there's also people getting punched through buildings, and people having a fight on a black hole and stars exploding and planets exploding and war scenes with soldiers shooting each other and tanks and battles and time travel. There's a lot of stuff in it. It was like, it was one of those things where I kind of poured my heart and soul into the novel because I rode this like energy to get it done. It was just an exciting project that I've never done. I've never attempted to write a book before. I never thought I was going to. And then I was just writing one. And then like 9 months later, it was done and it like kind of burnt me out a little bit because I just put so much into it. It's not long. It's not that long. It's average size book, but like I just, because I was playing with so many heavy concepts that it kind of burnt me and imagination down to the wick, and I had to like give it, you know, some years before I was able to like put it out again. Like I blew me load basically, and I need to let it build back up. But yeah, I know that was a big long stretch about the book and stuff like that, but I've been wanting to talk about it in those terms for so long, like because it's now past, we're past certain time. I'm able to like talk about it without fear of ruining things, if you know what I mean, which doesn't help.
Yeah, that's why we're here, right?
Yeah.
So when did you publish that book?
That was in 2021.
Okay.
Publisher was Beaten Track Publishing, which is head by the amazing Debbie McGowan, who is this just genius editor who she's I will say, I'm pretty sure she's currently a world record holder, but I don't think she knows it. She's an author herself, and she's written one continuous series throughout her entire career, and there's like 40 books, and I'm pretty sure that is a world record, but I don't think she's not really interested in that type of stuff anyway. But I'm there in the corner going, hello, accolade, there might be an accolade, you try and get an accolade, and she just does not care. Just, she likes what she does, and she's really good at her job.
That's awesome. So that's a traditional publisher then?
Non-traditional publisher, independent publisher, but I don't think there was a way to get this type of story on a traditional publishing thing. I didn't even try. I was happy because I was very lucky to have the publisher I have, because the very first time I ever did a podcast, someone said, how did you manage to publish a book? And I gave a one word answer, which was nepotism. And it's one of the things I will not allude to that fact whenever I'm mentioning anything. My mother met somebody whose mother was a publisher, and that was how it went through. And I'm insanely lucky that I was given a chance to like have a book printed in like hardback format and paperback format and ebook format and sent around the world and all the shops all the stores I like frequent through that connection. It was easier for me than a lot of people because I was helped by my family, and I really value that I got that help, and it like springboarded me into an entire career that I didn't know I was going to have. So that's fun. That's like awesome. I'm entirely grateful for that.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Thank you.
So can you touch on your short story called Lampoon?
Oh yeah, that was the short story called Lampoon, and that was the it was the follow up thing I published, because I'm ranking all my like book related products by published date, and I rank them as big projects in my mind, and because I've done only a small amount, each one's kind of important to me. So I'll give, you know, Lampoon its own cover, I've given it its own release, I've given it its own, like, I haven't given it a price though. It's never going to be charged for because it's a short story. And I don't think you should charge for single short stories. Some people do, and I know it's kind of, they'll probably think, you know, it's the only way to get money at the time, which is fine. But I don't want to charge for anything like that. So Lampoon was there was a independent writer who was looking for collaborators for an anthology, and it was one of those unofficial anthologies. It wasn't printed, it wasn't like actually put together with theme or like jacketed in any way with like you know, a poetic through line of a story. It was just random. It was just a random collection of stories, and I knew I met the person on Twitter. I liked the person. They were very nice, very like you know supportive, and very good at what they did. And I only had a username, but I thought that was good enough to work with them. So they were just made a small group and said, like Zeb, buddy, you want to write a story? So we all each individually wrote our own stories, and my one was the it was one of those I did not know what to write about for so long. And then I was just talking with people one day and just got the idea, and it was one of those saving grace ideas because it was coming close to the timeout. It was almost publishing time and nothing was done because, as I said, I was burnt out. So I just had this idea and then knew it wasn't going to be that long. I knew it was only going to be 10 pages as opposed to Juno, which was 350. So I knew it wasn't going to be like over 10. It was only going to be a short story. It wasn't going to go into novella territory, which some people can, like 30 pages. I wasn't going to do that. And I wanted to write something completely different. So that was where some of the burnout manifested, because trying to write different things instead of just writing the same things really difficult for like genre authors, I think. Because you know, we used to work with like time travel and stuff like that. So if we work sci-fi and space travel, you know, it's you have all that research bundled up in your head and knowledge ready to go. Whereas if you challenge yourself to write something dark and horror based and set in one small town with one individual character who is like a lying, morally grey. Like, I know morally grey is a silly term to describe, but he's like a down and out aggressor, where he is. His name's Ronnie Randolph, and he's a character who needs, he's one of those characters who needs help but won't accept it and would mock. And he's on the way to a pot to crash a party he was not invited to, out of spite. And then on the way to the party, he finds himself haunted through the woods, to get to the destination by something very familiar to him. And it's a cartoon version of himself. So, and it's kind of, that kind of is a spoiler, but it's not at the same time because the story's called Lampoon. The cartoon version of himself is making, it's like one night where someone's life is completely upended. And it's it was one of those like dark takes on like a Roger Rabbit thing, but it was also like inspired by like you know the work of like David Lynch, that type of thing. And it was really so I could just challenge myself and write about a small town with real people and problems that didn't come from like outer space, but were like economic problems that they were facing in their own personal life and relationship problems. And it was only in a short format, but I was quite happy personally with what I was able to like drag out during that like tricky time of trying to reformulate and get a new novel going. So that
Yeah.
story was published for free. It's on my website. It's on my Vero. If anyone wants to read it, you can. Not enough has been spoiled for it to not matter, but it was just a really good, fun story. I'll say good, but it's obviously not my judgment to make. I'm proud of it, basically. I'm proud of this short story, because it was like my first short story release, and that's kind of like a little milestone. So I like that. I just like hold it close to my heart that way. Not to be weirdly sentimental, about 10 pages.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. You touched on it already. Can you tell us anything more about your new novella?
Yes, I can. I'm excited to talk about this actually, because I have not talked about it publicly, so this is going to be fun. This novella, what is my next book, is actually a full book release. It is a novella, which is a shorter book, but at the moment, I'm luckily enough in a nice trend spot. I didn't aim for it. It wasn't actually supposed to be as long as it turned out to be. And the story's called Little Height Lies, and it started out life as a 10-page short story, And by the time I'd finished, it was 150. So it was one of those weird turn, like turn the wrong corner and just my, like I, one of the things I get compliments on as a writer, which is nice, is I don't know whether it's a basic compliment. It might just be a cookie cutter compliment, but I get compliments on my world building. And world building takes up a lot of pages if you do it in depth enough. So as I was building the world of this 10-page story, because it wasn't set like around a certain event, one night, one character, it was set around multiple characters, I ended up making an entire town. And then when I made the entire town, I ended up making events that connect the town and need, you know, have a history and a foundation that the town was built on. And then in the end, that got to like 60 pages. And I just kept going for as long as I could until it reached novella size, which is between 70 pages and 150, I think. 100 pages and 150, 70,000 words. And in the end, I managed to get it to something like 80,000 words or something like that.
Nice.
And it was the reason why it's been a bit of a strange time for me is because it was completely unplanned. It was just supposed to be short, and ironically, it just kept growing and growing and growing. And it itself turned into a little tight lie. The story follows, and this is the first time I've ever said this publicly, the story follows a down on their luck couple in the American, I'd say the American South, like kind of the this coastal side of America, as they try and reunite when their small town is attacked by a giant monster. So that's funnily fits in with the Godzilla King of the Monsters topic nicely. The twist with the story though is one of the characters is in a confined to a wheelchair and the other character is a moron. So like they have to overcome or try and overcome this enormous, larger than life creature that attacks their very small hilltop town on the coast. Southwest, I think it is, something like that. So it's putting characters who are very down on the luck, very traumatized, very out of the comings and goings of life, and pitting them against something that cannot be possibly avoided.
Interesting. And that comes out when?
That's got a 2026 release date at the moment. There's nothing finer yet because it's not fully exited the editing process yet. But the cover's done. That I found an amazing artist to do it. And it's the cover itself proper, like lends the credence to like the theme I was going for with it, where it's just, I wanted to make a pulpy, again, pulpy, I've said that before, but this 70s to 80s style Penny Dreadful-esque, like just cheap story, just this like classical stories that kind of don't exist anymore, where they're like larger than life out there sci-fi that is, you know, you can imagine the Godzilla text font with like wobbles and like where like it's like Ray Harryhausen style like monster movies. I wanted to like make that type of monster movie in book form, and the thing I latched on to in order to make that happen is the works of like Harlan Ellison, who did like stories like I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, and you know, compiled short story collections of like The Beast Who Screamed Love at the World, Shouted Love at the World, or Screamed Love at the World, I can't remember the word. One of my like prized possessions book wise is a copy of a reprinted copy of it's called Blood's a Rover, which is, you know, the famous story, The Boy and His Dog, which like inspired like, you know, the Fallout game series and Mad Max, where it's a lone traveler in a post-apocalypse with a dog companion. Like I got like a special like compiled collection of those stories, and they got like printed once and haven't been reprinted together since, and I managed to track one a copy of that down, and the cover's just one of those like classical, like, you know, red bordered 1970s like Amazing Tales style covers. And I really was drawn to that and kind of like settled in that niche. And I do think like I've managed to capture the feel, that feeling, that type of story feeling, like relatively well. But it remains to be seen whether or not it's like a, you know, a life changing work for somebody. Like it'd be nice if it was, just because it's another one written to kind of help, like take some air out of like the balloon of like political turmoil that everyone's in at the moment. Well, a lot of people are in, not everybody, obviously, but I just wanted to write a story that treats people like people, and also kind of is kind of cruel to problems in a way.
I like it. I can't wait to read it. You know, I do want to touch on another aspect of you that you do, and that is photography. So the main hub, I would say, for finding Liam's photography would be Vero, True Social. Can you actually touch on your experience using this app over the years?
So yeah, like algorithm free and like for you page free, so it's kind of helpful just to be able to control and manage your content and you know, share with followers and get support from followers on there. It's great. It is my favorite app.
Nice. Yeah, it's one of my favorites too. As in terms of like photography, can you talk a little bit about your style, like monochrome, the framing of your shots, what you photograph? What's Liam's style?
I love to go as cinematic as possible with the technology I have. I like big shots. I like shots with like, you know, big vistas, not landscape per se, but just I like out of the ordinary. I like you know, I love city shots. I mainly focus on color. I do think a lot of people don't focus that much on color because it doesn't lend itself like an art house feel to it. But I'm just going on what I think is some of my, you know, best results have come from color photography. Black and white. I do work with black and white sometimes, but I appreciate like more gray and black, like rather than like full monochrome, because it's cinematic. I like the old timey gray film look as opposed to like really high contrast, that type of thing. But I know it can have some good results with higher contrast though as well. It just depends.
What's a favorite photograph that you've shot?
My favorite photograph I've shot is actually the first one on my Vero profile. Actually, the first one is but it was a black and white shot. It looks cinematic. It was years and years ago. I was walking somewhere and I was with my mum, and you know, it was one of those times when you're just like out with your family, that type of thing. It started raining. She got an umbrella out and walked out ahead, and it's just like a shot of her walking down an alleyway with an umbrella in the rain, and it has like a Parisian energy to it. It's just like it was just a you know, right time, right place kind of shot. And that was the first upload I did on Vero. I also like there's a city shot as well, which is like two overlapping buildings that I got in Manchester, in the UK. I went there, and it was just one of those where I just looked up, and it for some reason it just framed itself like perfectly, and it was just it's a really great shot, in my opinion, of just two skyscrapers overlapping. That one is in color, and it looks, when I see it just doesn't look like something I've taken. It looks like something I've like watched on the internet or watched on a movie. It was that, like, you know, larger than life type of imagery that I like. But I'm really attracted to clouds now. Like I'm really interested in, like, it's one of the a big theme in my work is now clouds. I've got kind of a mini obsession about them. I don't know why. I think it comes from anime, but it's I went, like, you know, going out one time. I just went out to just do some photography, and I ended up like kind of chasing a cloud, like a single cloud, as it was like dissipating. So I was getting like different shots from different places and different periods of time as it was shrinking down. And it was just like a nice little mini project I set for myself. And it's an easy, that's kind of an easy cheat because, you know, nature's kind of doing everything for you. You don't really need to light it because it's lighting it yourself. It's doing all the hard work and you can just take some credit for it. I do a lot of video game photography as well, which isn't really seen as the same type of thing, but I don't know. I think it's a step up from AI, and I've had like, you know, photographs taken in game of like showcased on like the PlayStation blog and all that, like the official PlayStation blog. Because like I really they have this new feature now called photo mode in games, and I love that, and it gives you like all the cinematic tools you need without any expense, without any hard work, and it's like it's just really easy to like light and frame, and your subjects do whatever you tell them to because you physically have a controller. It's a director's dream, and with the graphics getting like even more realistic and stuff like that, it is genuinely working on like mini movies that you can just compose and frame and set up yourself and learn the tricks, and like you can like throw a grenade and wait till it explodes and then stop, freeze mid framing, and like use the grenade's flash as light and like light it that way. It's just like there's a lot of interesting things you can do, and I've been playing the new video game Ghost of Yotei, which is like Ghost of Tsushima's sequel, and that game is just, it's got like one of the best photo modes you can get. It's got like Akira Kurosawa mode, which is like the stylized black and white grain, but it's also got like something called Takeshi Miike mode, which is like more modern, more violence and more like art house, grindhouse stuff. And there's also like the things that people are making. It's just like it's just like it lets like people who live in like small towns kind of live out like little mini fantasies where it's just, you know, I'm not making a Spider-Man movie, but I can go into photo mode and compose shots that I would put in my Spider-Man movie. Like it's like storyboard. It's just nice.
You know, it doesn't surprise me that your photography has a cinematic quality because you are technically a filmmaker, right?
I haven't made a film in a long time, but the films I have made that I do like. I made two shorts, and I've written like a lot of screenplays. I was on the, you know, circling getting a TV show made, and it fell through. It always falls through. Like a lot. It's getting books made is way easier than getting a film made or a television project made, because you're working with some money, not belonging to other people, not a lot of money belonging to a lot of people. So it's quite tricky to get off the ground filmmaking career, especially nowadays when I swear if certain directors, like I'm not comparing myself to them, I'm just naming the examples, but if like, you know, Quentin Tarantino, Christopher Nolan, all the famous, you know, household names, David Fincher, I genuinely believe not one single one of them would be a filmmaker now if they had to do it, because I cannot imagine any of them going on TikTok mouthing and dancing. I just can't imagine them being able to let themselves loose like that. And I do think a lot of people were very lucky to not be coming up in the content age. I'm not like saying like, you know, I'm not a filmmaker anymore because all this stuff happens. Like I'm not a filmmaker anymore because I'm not making films. I am still a filmmaker. I still will make films. But at the moment, I'm concentrating on books because it's easier. And no offense to any authors who thinks it's not easier. It's you know, quantity wise, it is much less work. In less people involved, it's easier. But it's also getting a bit tricky regarding like storytelling as well, because, well, we've seen what we were talking about before with The World's Divide. That movie was made by one person, and that is described as it should be described, a feat of like authorship, like amazing authorship, like absolutely incredible work. to the point where a lot of people cannot imagine themselves doing it because of the amount of work needed to do that. That was like the ambition, like it really paid off of what the person set out to do. They sat down, they learned a program from scratch. They didn't even use the program. They learned how to use the program for the movie, and they did that. And a lot of people kind of aren't built that way. So there's other filmmakers out there, like not myself. I'm very purposely hanging back due to like I kind of fell in love with books a little bit, so I'm kind of exploring this a little more. But I have been, I the telly show I've been exp I was exploring. That was, I think, that was the thing where I went like I dipped my toe back into it on purpose, and then when that kind of fell through, I went, okay, I'm going to hang back again and give it a couple more years, just because it when I publish the book, you get like kind of instant gratification with that, and I didn't like the delay. So with that, I was going, no, I'll keep this like thing going through this like release. I'll keep that going for a bit because you get gratification, and I'm able to tell stories in a very specific way that's not like hindered, and it's way cheaper. It's way more solitary. But it's everyone says like writing's a lonely business and stuff like that. Everyone says that, but you don't really need to work with many other people to do it. Like it's kind of a blessing in its own right because you don't have like a million wages to pay. You don't, need to find where that money's coming from. It's kind of, as far as publishing ventures go, like for media, it's one of the cheapest ones you can do. And yeah, there will be some people who are saying, you have a phone, don't you? Why don't you just point your phone, make a movie that way? And you go, shut up. No one cares. No one wants to do that. No one wants to watch a movie about somebody walking around like a city and just goes without a plot. People want like IP and content now. So things that are taken off. Or like people are making fan films, but they're like that has costume requirements, and they are full like action. A lot of them are going on like a mini adventure thing. Everyone searches by brand now, so they don't just type in short film; they type in Batman short film. So it's a bit chaotic at the moment, the environment of like media making, and I will say it's also getting a bit cordoned off as well, so I'm not out of the filmmaker pool fully because I don't want to be locked out. There's a lot of like gatekeeping going on now with like agencies and stuff like that. In order to apply for certain agencies, apparently, this is just apparently hearsay, but I believe it. There's like nine different like programs that they have linked to that agency that they've partnered up that you have to go through, and it takes years, and they are very expensive, and so you are basically spending money to buy a career, and if you can't do that, you're out of the loop, and the like it's an instant rejection. So it's incredibly chaotic time to be a filmmaker, really. So it's a way better time to be an author. Apparently, though, that's not my story. It's someone else.
Okay. Wow, that's really interesting to learn about. So with your short films, I have noticed on IMDb the one was called Good Tidings. That was from
Yeah,
2016.
that wasn't my movie. I worked with, that was me working for someone there.
Right, you were a production assistant, right? Yeah.
That was
Yep.
it. I think that was shot in something like August or something like that of 2014 or 2015 or something like that. And that was a Christmas slasher movie, and it was British, small budget production. It was They had a budget of 8 million, 8 million. That would have been different. £8,000. So that's in terms of dollars. Oh God, it's changed so much recently. The factor of the pound to dollar ratio, but that would be maybe $16,000. I don't know off the top of my head what the currency exchange is. I might be like completely way off, but it would be like it won't be more than $20,000. Let's just say that. So that's what they were working with. That was my first like professional gig outside of like my own independent work, and I got that job. Luckily, I was lucky to get that job because it was one of those where if somebody heard about it and told me, so like I was lucky to be able to get that through the grapevine. That was fun. That was really fun. It was shot in like a courthouse, and it had all like, you know, the weapons and the fake blood, and the people pretended to be dead, and it's about three insane psychopaths who escape a mental institution and then crash a public court hearing, and at Christmas dressed as Santa Claus, and they start, you know, hunting the people through the chambers. I don't think the director's done anything since. I don't think the filmmakers have done much since. I think they started their own film festival though, which was cool, called the Dead of Night Film Festival. That was shot in a place called Southport, which is it's like a seaside town near Liverpool where the Beatles are from, that type of place. So all the characters, like all the actors, talk like Stephen Graham, like they all have the same accent as me, actually. So I don't know why I named Stephen Graham instead of myself. he's a better scouser than me. But the film is just, it's got a lot of heart. The writing like comes through like in a, it's got like a strong plot where it's not a final girl horror slasher with like it follows that formula. It tries to break out and do like its own thing with its own cast of characters. It tries to give a bit more sympathy to the you know, the antagonist as well, the villains. It's unique in it's seasonal themed, so it's one of those films where you kind of every year you look to compile a movie for Christmas, like a movie list for Christmas. A lot of people do that. It's a Christmas movie. You might not have seen it before. You should, you know, people should watch it. It should be online and stuff like that now, with the stream and stuff. I think it's on Amazon, actually. I think it's on Amazon Prime. I think so. Yeah, and it's, yeah, Good Tidings. And it's just a nice, fun little movie with a lot of heart and it'll be just a unique watching experience because it shows a part of like the world that a lot of people doesn't really get movies set in it. Like that type of town.
So what did a typical day on set look like for you?
Well, I was the jack of all trades type person. So I was like, production assistant really means like kind of jack of all trades sounds big, but it's not. It's kind of you go from department to department working with people in departments until you're sent to the other places. It's like, it's not like specifically like runner, which is kind of like the person who gets things from one place to another and does, you know, different tasks based on like what they're asked for, but you know, helping out on the production. So, you know, like there's like jobs that you don't really see in filmmaking publicly, where it's just a job. Whenever you see like the making of movies, they're always kind of set up. And they're just like shooting, but you know, something that's set up, so you don't really see like people putting marks on the floor, which is like coloured duct tape that tells the actors where they're going to stand and where they're going to go. You don't see anyone doing that. You don't really see people like actually setting up the camera equipment and getting the lenses out and making sure the, you know, calibrated properly and stuff like that. Make sure the cameras are, you know, everything works with the light, and then you know. All the equipment on the lights are actually in place, and like the gels and the different filters and stuff like that. So like I did all that type of stuff, like the behind the scenes, like technical work, that type of thing. And it was a fun experience because it was the first time I was working with like a big crew and stuff like that. But because I'm a director, I have like some not so fond memories where it's just like, I'm a director, so I'm not used to being told what, you know, I'm not used to being directed. And it was one of those things where I had to kind of get myself into like actual work mode, where it's like, no, you're not directing this time. Shut the fuck up. Do your job. Like, go do that. And I don't mean like I was having a tantrum over like not having, you know, responsibilities. It was more when you're on set, you kind of click into a character and like seeing how, you know, all the different technical aspects work on a more bigger budget, more professional level. So it was a really good experience. I'd do it again as well. I would do it now, actually. See what they're up to. Maybe I can see if there's anything going on in the same place, because it's just like, it's, I do want to be on a set again. I'm saying I want to be out in the, I'm out of the film industry for the second, but I do miss being on set. It's like, it's always a good experience. I'm one of those people who never sits down. So it's like, there's always something to do. You're always busy, and because you're always busy, you feel like you've accomplished a lot after like a day.
Right. Yeah. So I guess my next question, to kind of tie this all together, how does Specificity Archives play a role in all this?
Okay. Specificity Archives is my like host site where I put all my work on. It's like my personal website, but I might not be keeping the name. Because I like the name. It was my dream name. I've had it since I was little, like a kid. It was always going to be called Specificity something, and I liked archives because it was when I got into like publishing, but like getting books published and films and photography. It was like a mishmash, a collection. So it wasn't just like Specificity. It was going to be like Specificity Films, and then it was going to be like Specificity, like, you know, Specificity publish, not publishing, Specificity like authorship or something like that, I can't remember. And it was because it was like a big collection, it ended up just going with a more a library sense. So it was like archives was what I chose, and it had a nice ring. But that's kind of one of the amateur things where you go, yeah, that's what I had when I was planned when I was younger, and I absolutely did it, I made it happen. And then I started having to tell people to go to it. And it's a very rookie mistake, because you say Specificity and people go, oh, specifically. So then they can't find your site because they're looking for specifically. That just happened, actually. I was on a chat with somebody, and my name was Specificity A. And they went, oh, thank you, specifically. I went, okay, it's happening again. That was kind of the decision where I was going, like, I might just change it to either something more simple, like Spec Arc. To keep that like thing, because I did that on Twitter and all that, I changed my name from Specificity A and Specificity RK because it's my favorite word and I wanted it to be present. But it was alongside the a lot of lessons were learned from the first book. The first book was an accomplishment. I was very happy with it. I didn't get the I'm sorry about the sales speech that a lot of other authors get. So I was very pleased with that. I overcame that obstacle before, and I didn't think I would. So it was so apparently it sold all right. So that was a very good thing. But the little mistakes I ended up making were just like kind of admin mistakes, where it was like, again, name of website, links to things being all scattershot. That's another thing. Like, it would be good to, like, tie everything around one singular thing. So, there's a game reviewer who has a really, like, good sign-off thing, because they just say, if you need to find me, I'm at Laura H. Dern, and that's their name. And that's their at on every profile. And I'm one of those scatterbrain people who, like, I don't really look at, like, keeping things simple. I'm always trying to, like, go big and, try and, like, impress or whatever. But it turns out sometimes simple is complicated. And I didn't see that. So I might be changing the name of the site to, like, just liamquain.com. It's unique enough. Or Spec Arc or something like that. I'm not entirely sure yet. I'm currently working on the book at the moment, so I'm not thinking about that yet, but I will have a lot of post writing stuff to do, a lot of marketing to do. So I don't want to be handicapped with something confusing, like a big special academic word that only I have heard of and I'm so special. No, it's a very common word. A lot of people have heard it. It's in a lot of movies. But at the time when I got the idea, I was like, 11 and I thought it was the best thing ever. So it was that type of naive idea that I brought into adulthood, which was just silly.
No, I totally understand and can relate to what you're going through. So I can't wait to see what you rebrand to, and maybe there'll be a cool new logo.
Yeah, maybe actually I know how to get them done now. At the time, like the logo at the time, I did like the logo I've got, but it was one of those accidents where like the circle, like it's a bunch of, if anyone does know it, which no one will know it, it's a bunch of colored squares on a white background, and it was supposed to be, like one square was a different color, and that was specific the logo design thing, so that was the specificity part. But then because everything's formatted in a circle, the logo ended up accidentally being cut out into an S because it loops around, and then in the middle there's the specific different color. So you loop in and it loops around into an S, and the squares then become arrows pointing to the middle. So that's what my logo is at the moment, and that's the specificity thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, and there are some amazing artists out there that do a lot of amazing work with that. So, yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, Liam, we've talked about a lot of different things here today, a lot of different aspects of your career, of your life. To close with this episode, if there is any message that you want to convey to our viewers and listeners today, no matter which walk of life that they might come from, what would you say?
A good question. I like that one. I would say, kind of go try and go against the grain a little bit, like kind of not break rules, but kind of don't be boring. Do like try different things and help people just to help them. If to get a very dramatic, but like help people just to help people. Don't just do things for things in return. And I know people say like be kind and be nice, but actually learn why, like attach a measurable thing to being nice. You need to be nice. People need to be nice to each other. They need to help each other. The more society's kind of fragmenting and becoming more isolationist, the sicker everyone's going to get. So just find confidence in yourself to understand that more people are just as afraid of you as you are of them. And just reach out and actually be nice and help people and work together on things that it where in any format you can, whether it be on the internet or not. Nothing's cringe, nothing's sad, nothing's pathetic or embarrassing. Just if you want to do something, do the thing. If you want to help someone, help the person. If you want to reach out to people, reach out to them. Just take a bit of action and understand that, like, you are just a person on a planet, and anyone in power is just a person on that planet with you. Everyone's just human. Be human. Do things. Be active. Look after yourself and others.
I like it. Very cool. Well, Liam, thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of Heroes of the Media Escape. It's been a blast, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoy doing this type of stuff, and like this is like an amazing format to work in. You're an excellent host as well, very much so. And congrats on the rebrand. Congrats on like the build, the new build.
Thank you. Yeah, I can't wait to see what the next future episodes bring. I have a lot of really fun guests that I'd like to have on the
Awesome.
show that a lot of them are lined up already. So it's gonna be a
Cool.
lot of fun.
I'll be watching.
So awesome. All right. That's gonna do it. Have a good night, y'all.